I'm Tom McDonald, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Dave Heller is off this evening. Hundreds of people gathered at Philadelphia's Sheet Metal Workers Union this morning to show solidarity and strength before marching in the city's Labor Day parade. But for some, federal and state investigations into Philadelphia's most influential union leaders has loomed large. WHYY's Marielle Segura has more.
At around 9:30 a.m., Pat Iden, president of the Philadelphia Council AFL-CIO, got a crowd of union members revved up.
Today's your day. Make some noise. Today's your day.
He gave props to the nice weather.
The hurricane tried to come and get us.
And also took a jab at federal authorities.
The FBI is not here, so we're okay, I think. Stay over there. Get some of them bad guys. Leave people alone or doing something for working people.
Iding is referring to the FBI's investigation of John Dougherty, who heads Philadelphia's electricians union. Dougherty is widely considered the city's most influential labor leader. Over the last month, the federal agency has raided Dougherty's home, the office of a councilman, and union offices throughout the city. It's part of an investigation into the union's operations. This isn't Dougherty's first brush with the FBI. The agency investigated him and the head of an electrical contractor in 2006, but the labor leader wasn't charged. Earlier this year, the state launched an unrelated investigation into the electricians' union. Iding said many labor leaders in the city have a feeling of, here they come again.
They're constantly, always constantly trying to find out something we're doing wrong. And all we do is represent workers.
Nearby, hospital and healthcare workers union president Henry Nicholas said the investigation was just politics as usual and that he's focused on another issue.
We are committed to make sure that we elect a Democrat to the White House in November. The vote is the only thing that counts.
Mayor Jim Kenney, who was elected with the support of the electricians union, wouldn't comment on the investigation today, saying he wasn't going to let it impact the Labor Day celebration. Dougherty was not available for an interview. Marielle Segura, WHYY.
With the Labor Day weekend and summer winding down this evening, it's time for Philadelphia to turn to its annual September extravaganza, the Fringe Festival. Events get underway this coming weekend and run through the 24th. WHYY's arts and culture reporter Peter Crimmins sat down with NewsWorks theater blogger Howard Shapiro to preview this year's offerings.
So the Fringe Festival starts on the 9th, Howie. It starts very soon. It's upon us already.
Can you believe that it's 20 years? When the first one opened, it was almost all in Old City, the part of that eastern part of Center City, you know. Now it's in, I think, 9 neighborhoods, including Center City, of course. Right. It's got 33 dance pieces, 12 music pieces, more than 70 theater pieces.
It's come
all
a long
together.
Way. 20 years, come a long
it's
way.
It's come a long way, and it still is partly curated, right? Stuff the fringe arts people, they bring in, they commission, they sponsor them. And then the free-for-all, what I like to call the free-for-all fringe.
Yeah, so the festival, as it has been for a long time, it sort of split into these two entities, the curated fringe and the fringy fringe, as we like to call it. And the curated fringe, a lot of it is coming from overseas. A lot of international artists come in, a lot of big-time people come into people who otherwise probably wouldn't be coming here were it not for the Fringe Festival to invite them over.
So one of the things I'm looking forward to this year is his third time at the Fringe as a choreographer named Jerome Bell, a controversial maker of art in that he doesn't do dance the way you think of dance. He picks people essentially off the street, although it's not quite like that. And then he pairs them or either doesn't with professional dancers and they create a dance. This year, he's doing something called Gala. With 20 dancers, some of them professionals, some of them just from around here. Mm-hmm. And
some of them with no dance experience at all.
There's, yes, that's right.
There's a local company, the Sunshine Performance Corporation, and they're doing this sincerity. It's called the Sincerity Project, this thing that they're doing. But it's a really long-term commitment on behalf of the performers in that company. 24 years. Every 2 years, they will perform some show that reflects how they're living right now, how the individuals, the performers, are living right now. And they'll do that every 2 years for 24 years.
Right.
So it's really literally a lifetime project for them.
What are you going to see?
One thing I was curious is two pieces that come from Africa, specifically the Congo. There's a dance piece called Le Cargo, mm-hmm. which is a dance piece basically about the modern history of this place called Congo. It's gone through several names in the last 100 years or so. And it's sort of this choreography journey through the history of Congo.
Of Congo, yeah.
And there's another piece called, it's Macbeth. It's a telling of Verdi's opera Macbeth. But it's set in the Congo.
It is. And, you know, it's being done with Opera Philadelphia.
Well, I'd like to talk about what might be called the fringy fringe, the outlying fringe, because that's where it gets its name. And there's still companies that seek out really raw spaces and create really odd and experimental work that you kind of expect from something called a fringe festival.
Right.
So I visited someone who was preparing a work, and this is Southwest Philadelphia. It's in a former paint factory that has only recently been transformed into artist spaces, and they're working up this piece about traveling to Mars. You know, what goes into that? What sort of emotional, psychological drive would want you to go a one-way ticket to Mars, you'll never come back? It's called
yes.
One-Way Red.
One-Way Red?
Yeah. You know, there are two companies that have been doing the fringe for a while. They're still pretty young, and they're up and coming. One is Applied Mechanics, which has done some really great work in the fringe in the past few years. They do a show called Feed, which is about food. And before the festival starts, they're going around to farmers markets to do sort of pop-up performances, little excerpts of the thing, to kind of get people who go to farmers markets excited about it. And also, there's another company called Renegade Company. They're doing something called Animal Farm to Table, which is the telling of Animal Farm, but it's set in a community garden or an urban garden up in Northern Liberties, I think it is, or even Kensington maybe. And it's, again, a food-related piece about urban farming as a retelling of Orwell.
There are a couple other companies that pop up almost every year recently. One is called Tribe of Fools, which is reviving its show about the Philadelphia Parking Authority and parking meters, called Antihero. And another group that's had some real dark horse hits in the show is called the Berserker Residents, also a Philly troupe. This year they're doing a show that I'm not going to say the whole title of, but I'll call it I Dare You, which has in it a decaying manor that somebody lives in and a shut-in. It's going to be upstairs at Plays and Players, which is up on the third floor by their bar. You know, we ought to say that this year the Fringe has really taken off with videos you can watch for free at home. That part of the Fringe Festival is really egalitarian. You know, anybody can join it without a ticket.
Something they started last year, and it's really expanded this year, is I think what you're talking about, the Digital Fringe, what they're calling
the
Digital
Fringe.
They call
it the Digital Fringe.
It's a new neighborhood, so-called, in the guide there. There's some real interest in these things that you don't actually have to physically go to a space. You just go to your computer and you log on and something interesting happens. And it's really expanded a lot.
And we also want to say that for another year, after all these shows are done at night at around 10 o'clock, there's a huge fringe bar at the Fringe Arts Building, which is a real scene. I mean, there are acts scheduled, but a lot of it is people who just want to come together and talk about performing and making art and being weird. And so am I going to see you there?
You're going to see me there. I'll be there too.
Okay. I'll fringe with you, Peter.
Okay. Thanks, Howard.
WHYY's arts and culture reporter, Peter Crimmins, speaking with Newsworks theater blogger Howard Shapiro about this year's Fringe Festival. We'll have more Fringe coverage throughout the next couple of weeks on Newsworks Tonight and newsworks.org. Still ahead, at the start of a new school year, students and parents aren't the only ones who might be nervous. New teachers often don't know what to expect either.
So in the old days, so to speak, maybe back in the 1980s, the predominant thing was what we called the sink or swim model.
Now, many school districts are beefing up the orientation they give to new teachers. That's coming up as Newsworks Tonight continues on WHYY. Welcome back to Newsworks Tonight. I'm Tom McDonald, in tonight for Dave Heller. The first day of school is a nervous time for parents, for students, and even for teachers, especially new teachers. 20 or 30 years ago, most rookie teachers would receive a textbook and a pat on the back before their first day in the classroom. Today, the process looks and sounds a lot different. WHYY's Ari Wolfman-Arendt has more.
Good morning, everybody.
Good morning.
Good morning.
It's a steamy summer morning in early August. Scott Gordon, CEO of the Mastery Charter School Network, is pacing the aisle of a packed school cafeteria. About 250 teachers stare back at him from long, laminate tables. Each of these teachers started with Mastery about 10 minutes ago. It's been an intense 10 minutes.
About 1 in 10 kids who enter kindergarten will actually go on and get a bachelor's degree. 1 in 10.
For 15 years, Gordon has delivered a version of this talk. It's the first thing new hires hear when they arrive at Philadelphia's largest charter chain. And it's more sermon than welcome, complete with brimstone and fire.
So for Mastery, the house is on fire. We don't have a small problem or a little adjustment. We have a generation of young people who fundamentally are not getting what they need.
Behind Gordon, there's a projected image of a house consumed by flames. His point? Public education is a smoldering mess, and you teachers, you're the ones holding the hose. Now, if you have strong opinions about public education, you're probably either pumping your fist right now or rolling your eyes. But set aside those emotions for a second and imagine that this is just any company, and the head of this company is telling all of his new employees that the world they're entering is in shambles. You have to wonder, why?
Mastery was founded with a purpose to address a problem that public education is not working for all kids. And so starting out with day one, that we have a problem, that young people are not getting what they need, and we are here to try to address that problem, that's the most important thing.
Gordon's speech kicks off a 5-day orientation Mastery holds every year for new teachers. It's peppered with all sorts of detailed information about Mastery's curriculum, its teaching methods, even how to use its technology. But above all, it's designed to get teachers to buy into Mastery, its mission, its culture.
That I think we look at great organizations, school districts, hospitals. I think start with the fundamental. Why are we here? What's the purpose?
Corporations have been posing that very question for decades. There are reams of research on what's called employee onboarding, or the process of bringing on new hires. Schools, however, are only starting to catch up.
So in the old days, so to speak, maybe back in the 1980s, the predominant thing was what we called the sink or swim model.
Richard Ingersoll studies teacher onboarding at the University of Pennsylvania.
You were on your own, and some would swim and some would sink. And you're really quite isolated.
But these days, according to Ingersoll's research, about 9 in 10 new teachers get some sort of targeted help. Sometimes that's as simple as regular chats with the principal. In other cases, it's more involved. Meredith Mera is the School District of Philadelphia's Executive Director of Teaching and Learning, and she's leading an overhaul of Philly's orientation for new hires.
You're coming into a large district, and there's so much that in terms of systems and people that you don't know, and it creates apprehension, and that translates to your students.
2 years ago, the district held a voluntary 3-day orientation for new teachers. Only about 50 people showed up. This year, the district expanded to a 5-day extravaganza with over 500 new hires. And unlike Mastery, the district focuses less on culture and more on familiarizing teachers with the ins and outs of district protocol. Mera also wants teachers to meet other teachers, to feel like they have allies in the sprawling world that is Philadelphia education.
There's going to be a day in January where it was dark when you got up in the morning and it was dark when you went home, and you may need to reach out to a lifeline and say, hey, remind me why I do this so I can go back in tomorrow. And they're going to be able to reach out to folks now who they have formed relationships with here outside of their building.
Ingersoll, the Penn professor, says there's no specific research on the effectiveness of these teacher orientations, but there is general research showing that support for new hires can reduce turnover and increase student test scores. So, is it worth the effort? Alicia Devane certainly hopes so.
I didn't really have many expectations. I was like, 5 days, that's going to be a lot.
Devane will be teaching middle school science this year at B.B. Comegys School in Southwest Philadelphia. She's still sizing up this orientation experience.
So it's kind of like, you know, when you eat like a chicken wing. You know, you eat what you need to and you spit out the bone, the stuff that you don't like.
Some of the training she's gotten on specific district protocols it can feel a little abstract, but she's enjoyed meeting other teachers. It's motivation, she says, and a subtle reminder that she isn't in this alone. I'm Avi Wolfman-Arendt, WHYY News.
Our Milky Way galaxy has roughly 100 times more stars than the nearby Dragonfly 44 galaxy. Yet, if you set the two on a balance scale, their masses would be nearly the same. NewsWorks Tonight's Dave Heller asked Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute, for some answers.
Derek, this dragonfly is no lightning bug. It burns pretty dim.
And what a surprise this is, because if we look at how galaxies evolve and what their structure is and what we expect of their behavior, a galaxy that appears to be this size and this mass, like ours, should be very much brighter than it appears.
So what is the normal behavior of a galaxy?
Well, typically a galaxy like ours that has 300 to 400 billion stars has enough mass there represented by the stars to hold the galaxy together, to keep it all together. So
what's the glue holding this one together?
What is the glue holding this one together? We could guess maybe two things are going on. One of the things could be that the cluster that this galaxy is part of, the mass of that cluster of galaxies is actually ripping this galaxy apart. So what astronomers have done is they've done a spectroscopic analysis of stars in this galaxy, the few that they can find. The idea is to try to determine whether or not there's actually some motion in this galaxy, or instead, if the cluster itself is tearing the galaxy apart. The stars they can see do have quite rapid motion, so that indicates that it's not the cluster tearing it apart, but something else that's holding it together.
Something internal to the galaxy.
Something internal to the galaxy. Now, since we can't really see anything, well, you know, the big culprit for having an effect on objects in the universe these days when you can't see it is dark matter. And so, astronomers are now speculating that in this particular case, this is a galaxy that may be 99.99% dark matter, with that last little bit just being the few stars that can be seen.
Is the term dark matter synonymous for astronomers with, I don't know what this is?
While it may seem like it's a great catch-all term because, in a sense, we don't know what it is, and therefore, without a definition of what it is, couldn't it be anything? So it's not the first time that a galaxy with characteristics like this has been identified. There's a galaxy in the Virgo cluster that also seems to be devoid of stars, yet has this incredible mass of which 99.97% is identified to be dark matter. We clearly now understand that the universe cannot do what we're seeing it do right now without the effects of dark matter and dark energy. I mean, the universe is expanding faster and faster, and so we know that that, along with many, many other phenomena that we see in the universe, have to be tied to dark matter and dark energy, even though we cannot clearly define exactly what they are.
Thursday, a day of note for science lovers worldwide.
And I think it's one of the most significant anniversaries we can think of. It's the 50th anniversary of the premiere of the original Star Trek series. I remember back in those days when this program first began, what an amazing journey this program took us on. And it turned out to be much, much more than just a plain science fiction tale about a group of explorers traveling through the galaxies, but it turned out to have so many more dimensions to it of morals and judgment that you might not typically find as part of the theme of a science fiction program.
Is it a stretch to say it might have in part motivated you and others to seek out this chosen profession?
It is incredibly inspirational, and we know that the spacefarers of today, those who are even on orbit right now, are aware of and appreciate this series in all of its manifestations from those beginnings in 1966.
Thanks, Derek.
Live long and prosper, Dave.
Derek Pitts, chief astronomer at the Franklin Institute. He joins us each week at this time on NewsWorks Tonight.
Dave Heller boldly goes where no man has gone before with Derek Pitts every Monday on NewsWorks Tonight. That's all for tonight's show. NewsWorks Tonight, produced by Shai Binyakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Host Dave Heller is back tomorrow. You can find our show on iTunes or listen back at newsworks.org. Thanks for joining us. I'm Tom McDonald for NewsWorks Tonight.